Welcome to the Brandy Gamer Podcast, episode 29 for June 13th, 2010. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me as always. This edition of the show features an interview with writer and journalist Tom Bissell. Tom's new book, Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter, was published this week by Pantheon Books. And it's a book that I think any listener or reader of my blog will be keen to read. It's an important book, I think, because it blends experiential writing about games with Tom's particular brand of sharp criticism and informative journalism. Tom is a terrific writer, and Extra Lives is the thoughtful and passionate book about games that I think many of us have been waiting for. So, my thanks to Tom for joining me. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and away we go. It is my great pleasure to welcome Tom Bissell to the podcast. Tom has appeared on the Gamers Confab segment before, but this is a much bigger deal, and I'm thrilled to have him because his new book, Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter, appeared on bookshelves this week. It's a book that I feel pretty passionately about. It's one of the best books on video games that I've ever read, and I want to encourage everyone to read it. I think a lot of people agree with me about this, so I'm not kind of out there on the margins waving my arms for you to read Tom Bissell's book. I think a lot of people want you to read Tom Bissell's book. And if you're not familiar with Tom, he's written for Harper's Magazine, The New Yorker, The New Republic. He's published several previous books, including Chasing the Sea, The Father of All Things. He was a recipient of the 2010 Guggenheim Fellowship, and he currently teaches fiction writing at Portland State University. Tom, welcome back to the show.
It's beyond a pleasure to be here. It's just great. I love these podcasts. I listen to every one of them, and so to be the guest upon whom you lavish attention for the next 45 minutes or so, the honor is all mine. Believe me.
Oh, well, I'm glad to have you on it. I've been anxious to talk to you about this book ever since you were kind enough to give me, you know, a couple of early drafts to look at. And that process for me, I mean, that doesn't happen to me. Authors don't send me drafts of books very often. So it was just a real thrill for me to kind of watch it take shape. But more than that, you know, I feel like I've been kind of walking around with this secret in my mind, you know, like this is this really great book, people. You got to wait. It's coming. And it's finally here. I'm thrilled for you. I'm thrilled for us gamers who, I think, have been looking for this book for a long time. I think some of us have been writing our portions of this book in a certain way, our take on some of the things that you've been writing about in short bursts in blogs and things. But, you know, you're the first person to really devote himself to it in a significant, ongoing way. It's a full-length, very ambitious work. And I just can't wait to dig into it and talk to you about it. So welcome and thanks for the book.
My pleasure. And I should say that the whole reason I wrote this book is, I think, because I don't have a blog, so I didn't really have anywhere else to go with this stuff other than like the traditional old media path that I'm unwisely wedded to, you know. But you know, people like you and you know, I best, you know, the seven or six people you and I know in common who write about games, you guys were all, you know, you're the co-conspirators of this book. And if it hadn't been for my stumbling upon your stuff and realizing that this area of game writing that doesn't exist, because I was just reading, you know, the magazines, 5-6 years ago, if I would have known that you guys were out there a little bit sooner, you know, maybe this book would have gotten written sooner. I don't know. So I'm grateful to you. And before, you know, the mutual love fest here forms a black hole that sucks us both into it, maybe we should
Well, let's talk a little bit about timing, and before we talk specifically about the book, is the reason the game sort of world evolved because we sort of started to pay closer attention to it, or because games got better? Why would you write this book now and say not 7 or 8 years ago?
All I can tell you is that I played games kind of guiltily, is not the right word. I enjoyed myself, and what's not to enjoy? I would play with my friends. We'd play around. We had a good time. They were never really anything that got inside my head or under my skin. For that, I went to literature. You know, for that, I went to writing. And then in about 2007 or so, I think kind of around the time my last book came out, which is a book about my father in Vietnam that meant a lot to me, that I worked very hard on, that got really good reviews, and which kind of just, you know, didn't really do anything commercially or culturally. And I wasn't expecting much, believe me. When I say it didn't do anything, I mean it didn't do anything. And into sort of a dark place a little bit. And the thing I took with me into that dark place was games. And it was the first few games that I was playing during this kind of period of disappointment for me, where I really began to look at these things and say, these things are doing something more than just entertaining me. I'm taking into these things concerns about form and about, you know, concerns about narrative and dramaturgy. You know, all these pretentious things that I went to and thought about with regard to fiction were suddenly invading my game playing time in really interesting ways. And I started to actually think about some of the formal decisions I was seeing kind of get a little bit more codified in sophisticated game design. And I got really interested in it. And this is when I, you know, around 2007, began to think to myself, my God, this is an entirely new form of storytelling that has absolutely no precedent. And we are watching something happen here that I've just found really interesting. And I became a bit of an evangelist about it. Mm. And you know, as you know, there weren't a lot of people on our side of things. There's a lot of really smart, sophisticated people talking about this stuff, sure. But they're coming from the game design stuff. You come out of theater, I come out of literature. I think there were fewer people like us who were taking to this world our concerns about our own mediums, and wondering how the game medium affected all, you know, what we were interested in.
You know, you mentioned you're a serious writer. You've written collections of fiction. You've written, you know, an extraordinarily moving book about your family and your relationship to your father, as you mentioned, who was a Marine in Vietnam. Was there ever a moment when you were writing Extra Lives, or when you were considering writing Extra Lives, that you thought, you know, what am I doing writing about video games? I'm going to sabotage my whole career here.
You know, I would be lying if I said no, but I would also be exaggerating if I said yes. I think I realized early on that when I wrote, you know, before I wrote the book, I wrote a piece about Cliff Bleszinski for The New Yorker. And that just seemed like a complete and total lark. You know, like the most beautiful girl in the room crossing at the party, coming over to it, looking at you and saying, let's go back home and jump into bed. I was getting to write video game about video games for The New Yorker. I mean, that was just, I was endlessly delighted by the perversity of that. Yeah. And the piece got such a great reception, I have to say, that I actually thought, well, you know, gosh, this is really weird. This thing that I thought was kind of funny and vaguely embarrassing, they were all really into. And it got such a good response that I actually thought to myself, what if I did a whole book of that? Mm. Would that work? So I talked to my editor and he's like, write a proposal. I did the proposal. I wrote it in a night and it just came out. And everything that I couldn't say in the New Yorker piece, because it wasn't about me and what I was thinking about. It was about Cliff, his universe and what game design actually is today. But, you know, all the things that I was, you know, because I'm a writer and I desperately want to talk about myself. All the things I was trying to say in that piece that were around the edges of it, I suddenly just said in this proposal. And I knew things were kind of changing, A, when The New Yorker ran that piece, and B, when the guy who runs Pantheon and the guy who runs Knopf, which is to say Dan Frank and Sonny Maida, who are probably the first and second last people on the planet you would ever imagine wanting to read about video games or be interested in them. They both came back and said, yeah, this is interesting. Do it. Hmm. And so that's kind of how it happened. So I did worry about that a little bit. But, you know, so far, those fears have been so completely overthrown that I just feel like for once in my life, I've actually written a book that was kind of well-timed, you know, and I feel like all of the stuff that's been happening in the last, not that long either, and you're a part of it. You're a huge part of this, Michael, that all the stuff that's been in motion thanks to people like you, it all feels like it's coming to a head now a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I was just thinking as you were talking that, you know, in my last podcast, I interviewed Jamin Brophy Warren and Chris Dallin, who essentially are also betting the farm on the idea that people who play video games or are curious about games read.
Yeah,
that we believe that they read. And I think that's actually kind of still, you know, we have to prove that. You know, I mean, I think we are proving
we know some of them do.
Well, I mean, but
we don't know how many yet.
Right. That's the question. And but it does seem to me that there's a real momentum. I mean, if you just look at the space that I occupy, which is an online space shared with lots of other people, you know, carving out our own little audiences and stuff. I mean, one thing we know is it's extremely vigorous. I mean, people are, you know, they're not just a little bit interested. They're really interested and they want to be part of this conversation.
Yeah. And they're really interested because it's really interesting.
Yeah.
What does it mean for storytelling and, you know, and narrative that this form of storytelling is coming up and there aren't really any rules yet? It is like it's the Wild West, you know, and there's like a land rush right now and everybody's going out and planting their flags and the methodology and the set of storytelling principles that they think are the ones.
Yeah.
And when is the last time this happened? It was film. It was 100 years ago with film.
Yeah.
One of the reviews that my book got said video games are where film was 100 years ago. And I was like, are you shitting me? That's not even close to being accurate. You know, video games are where films were like 50 years ago, maybe. But not 100. Not 100.
Well, it's funny, too, because I think if you look at the kind of work that we would probably call early criticism of film, it was highly evangelical. It's very similar, I think, in some ways to what a lot of people, certainly I have to cop to this myself, that you're functioning as a critic, but you're also functioning as a person who's trying to sell this thing, mm-hmm. you know, and just sort of to people who haven't quite understood or who have a series of misconceptions about what this thing is, that if you just keep building a case and you keep talking about them in interesting ways, or if, you know, people like you write books about it in really accessible but penetrating ways, we're eventually going to stop needing to feel like we need to evangelize and we're just going to get down to doing our business.
Yeah, I tried to evangelize as little as possible in the book. And that's what I like about your site, too, is that you just kind of take it as read that these are interesting, right? But one of the other goals that I had, and that's something I sense in you a bit, too, is that on the one hand, you want to make people who aren't convinced convinced. On the other hand, you want to tell people who are convinced that their case isn't as good as they think it is.
Yeah, this is interesting to me. You know, you spend a fair amount of time kind of walking that line in the book that you simultaneously seem to just be exhilarated by what happens to you when you play these games. And they're mostly narrative games that you deal with.
Yeah.
But at other times, you're just throwing up your hands at how ridiculous they are and how lame brain they are and how immature they are.
Well, let's talk about that because... a lot of times writing this book, little pieces of it would appear. I do, you know, I've done some publicity stuff and I'm reading the comments of it, of these things. And people are saying, why do you jerks always ruin everything with your talk about stories? And stories don't have to be good. It's a video game. And so there's part of me that agrees with that line of thought, which is, no, we don't want stories to be good in the way literary fiction is good. And no, we don't want movie stories to be good. But I think what the answer that is no longer good enough is that it's a video game. The story's supposed to be stupid. Mm. That is an enraging, self-defeating, completely whack way of operating. And we just should not allow games that are dumb about their storytelling anymore. We should demand games that are smart about good video game storytelling. And like constantly pushing developers not to insult us with these, like I'm playing Alan Wake and I'm collecting fucking thermoses. It's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. This is a game that takes its storytelling and its, you know, character stuff seriously. It's like, we're a story game. We're interested in these characters. We want the verisimilitude of this world to be something that you buy. And we're going to make you stop and collect thermoses.
But he's a writer, Tom. I mean, aren't you connecting with him as a writer?
No, I'm not. I'm just like, I understand where the collectible school of game design comes from. I understand how in some games it's important. I understand like the purpose of it. But in a game that takes its storytelling at all seriously, the collectible design choice is you may as well just pump an entire round, you know, automatic weapon fire in your own foot. It's stupid. It's just, it's completely dumb. And it's not dumb in a cute, funny way. It's dumb in a mystifying way, because all it does is just like make you think, what, how can you take this fiction? Not the fact that you're burning darkness off people with a flashlight. I take that seriously in the game world. But it's like, how do I take the rules of this fictional universe seriously when there's something so stupidly arbitrary as the thermos collection?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of storytelling that I'm no longer willing to forgive.
It's a strange kind of tension, I think, because you talk to designers. I was just talking to one the other day, in fact, about this very thing, that there's a kind of an imperative for a designer that you have to include gameplay stuff and these conventional things, collecting things, whatever, that they're a necessary part of the process, and that it is, in fact, it becomes about industry things like, I can't get this game made unless it has those gameplay elements in it. So I got to put them in, even though I couldn't be less interested in them, and hopefully we can make a good narrative, you know?
Well, then games deserve whatever they get. Because if people are capitulating to that kind of pressure, I understand everyone makes capitulations as a writer and as a creator. You do. But if you're making a capitulation that's that internally damaging, that's not good enough to me. I don't. And if everyone in game design thinks that stuff like collectibles is just what you have to do, well, then I cannot think of a better reason to overthrow some of the reigning conceptual, you know, frameworks that people who design games think under. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just a sign that some of them just need to start changing now. And I know that sounds like really mean and pretentious, and I know I must sound like a complete dick, and I don't mean to. I'm saying this out of a place of like desperation for this form like moving forward in a way that measures up to our own estimation of what it's capable of.
Some of the biggest resistance I find, and when you look at games that try to do something different or that experiment, some of the most savage critics of those games are gamers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mirror's Edge is a case in point, which I think is an absolutely brilliant game that I cannot say enough good things about. And people hate it. I don't get it.
Yeah, there's so many things I want to talk to you about with the book, but let's just take 30 seconds. Give me your best shot at why Mirror's Edge has been mistreated by critics.
It's visually, it doesn't look like anything else. It takes all of the, like, the grammar of the shooter and tries to build a game designed about running from people rather than like actively engaging them. It makes an unbelievably brave decision, you know, tie its mechanical character to world interface with this first person viewpoint that is like you very hostile to the kinds of things you're doing and the kinds of timing you need to do. But its use of sound and jostling and camera work is, I think, so good and so sophisticated that when you hit a ledge and you pull yourself up on it, it manages to just pull you in there, even though all you're seeing is the tips of someone's fingers. I find that extraordinary.
Is the storytelling compelling to you?
I love it because it's like pretty thin gruel. It doesn't take itself very seriously. And the real storytelling is how I ran away from that helicopter that was shooting up everything around me and the shortcut I found through those buildings.
Right.
That's the storytelling that it's really pumping all of its juice into. And that's the story that I responded to.
Right.
That dime store story of like who killed the mayor and all that, it took it just as seriously as it needed to, I thought. I thought it was a textbook case in like how to do a good game, but you know, I think it sold like 7 copies. So there's actually one in my local Office Max for $8. Every time I walk into it, I look at that poor game and I'm like, I already have a copy of this, but I feel like buying it again just because it makes me so sad to see it. Yeah.
Well, actually, I'll have to. I mean, I found the platforming part of it terribly frustrating. I got very frustrated with trying to get the right jump and aim myself in the right direction and hit the right place. And at a certain point, I got angry at the game, and I think that's what drove me away from it.
It might be that I'm just so extraordinarily good at it.
That must be it.
For me to like understand other
people. Yeah, the rest of us can only admire. Well, so let me ask you this. You've talked a little bit about you're skeptical of a certain kind of storytelling in games, this notion of emergent narrative games, sandbox games. As I understand it, your basic take has been, if I wanted to create my own story, I'd write a book or I'd write a story. I don't need a video game to make me do that. What's your take on that?
No, my resistance is to the outcomeless open world game.
So a game where you're essentially
grinding.
Yeah.
I don't think those games serve any purpose. I mean, who am I to say? They don't serve any purpose for me, and they make me feel bad after I've played them for a while. I love open world games. It's my favorite school of game, but I like Diamond. You know, you start out and then you have all these possibility narrative branches going off in the middle. And then by the end of the game, they've all kind of narrowed again. You know, I think for all sorts of technical reasons, which I'm more and more beginning to understand, you know, this illusion of like branching narrative in open world games is just that. It's a complete illusion, because a game like literally can't accommodate the kinds of choice that you think you're getting in those sorts of games. And that's why Warcraft has no outcome, because how could it possibly accommodate the millions of people's personal narratives that are playing and all those decisions that get made in that game? So to me, just for me personally, John Q, video game player, the Warcraft style of open world game, where you're just exploring a world that you're not getting any kind of aesthetic reward, any kind of narrative thrown back at you by the author figure, I find that gameplay just really empty personally.
Hmm. But you're more receptive than some to a linear authored narrative.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's three or four totally viable kinds of schools of design. And I think three or four can do like totally fantastic gaming experiences. Do you sort of get sick of this idea that like if it's an on the rails game, it's somehow corrupt or inferior? You know what I mean? There is an answer, that there's a good answer. And I'm not sure there is one yet.
At the conference I just attended, the Games Learning and Society conference, Richard LeMarchand was there, who was the co-lead on both of the Uncharted games. And I thought he handled that question really quite elegantly. I mean, I think a lot of people are doing this. I think even Clint Hawking would say something. I think he even said something similar to this on my podcast one time, that let's not get ourselves trapped into this binary notion that there's only one way of doing it and the other way is bad.
Yeah.
And he prefers not to do linear stories with a kind of a single ending or whatever. But, you know, if you're going to build an Uncharted 2 game and your goals are what the goals of that game are, that's a pretty darn good way of making a game.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of fun.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. But so is Red Dead Redemption.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very anti-cutscene, for instance. Yeah. But I love the cutscenes in Red Dead, and I love the cutscenes in Uncharted, and I love them because they obviously had actors working together. They took the mocap seriously. They took all the elements of the cutscene experience. They really committed to them. And I hate cutscenes because most of them are poorly acted, badly written, inadequate cartoons.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why they do it. Like the Marston cutscenes, that actor, his name, I forget his name, but that kind of hoarse, heartsick voice that guy has.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the most extraordinary video game performance I think I've ever heard. I don't think I've ever seen a better video game performance. And there were moments of that the way he looks at someone, or his eyes, or the way he says something and looks away. I was not looking at pixels. I wasn't watching cartoon. He was a living dude, and I was watching him struggle with something. And man, that was an exciting feeling to feel that.
You watch the credits at the end of that game, the number of actors listed, just blows your mind.
It really does. So who would want to live in a world in which one of those methodologies won and the other was like crushed and vanquished, and the Amy Hennings of the world were no longer allowed to make games? That would be a miserable, dark, terrible world.
It's funny though, because you play, and I've definitely done this, you look at a game like Red Dead and you think, well, if only it had been more open. It still kind of lingers in the back of my mind that there is out there that perfect game that kind of does it all, that has the great voice acting, that has the great character work, but that's less, you know, the Mexico segments are really troubling and the storytelling there and all, what sort of how it goes wrong there, in my opinion. But if you left more to the player in that game and you trusted the player more and let the player experience the world, which is so extraordinary, more, you might be able to get something of both of them and kind of elevate the game even more.
I think you might be right. And I think maybe even the people who made it would think you're right. And I think maybe the way game production schedules work, that by the time anyone had seen sort of the thing they were resting out of nothing, you can't really write that ship. That's the nice thing about writing a book or being a poet or a short story writer, you know? You can throw away a couple of years of work and just start over. But I spent the first like maybe 4 or 5 hours thinking, at last, a narrative open world game. I mean, that game has collectibles, doesn't it? But it tries to incorporate them meaningfully within the fictional framework that it's operating in. And it's trying to disguise the inevitable tension between gameplay and narrative, and it's trying to incorporate it and disguise it in a really smart way. And I thought that it had actually come closer to than any game I'd seen. And then you actually realize later that no, it just delays the inevitable reckoning of, oh God, this is just as silly as every other game that tries to do this. You know, like for instance, when you're in some heated chase across Mexico trying to do something and someone's like, hey, can you help me find my family's ancestral treasure? And you're like, oh, okay.
I'm on it.
Yeah, I'll do that. Sure.
There's a funny moment in Red Dead at the end. I guess I won't do spoilers, but there's a certain kind of ending.
No, let's spoil it. I'm anti-spoiler. I love spoilers. Let's
yeah,
spoil it.
I got I really screwed up in a post that I made on the game where I put the spoiler warning in the wrong place.
You did, and I have a friend who actually wants to physically hurt you.
Oh my God.
I know.
It's the dumbest thing I've done since I started the blog. Well, among the dumbest things.
Way to go.
But yeah. Like true hate mail. I really honestly got like about a dozen hateful messages. Anyway, there's a, you know, at the end of something very, very conclusive happens. And it's common knowledge. There's a character named Bonnie. She's the first woman that Marston meets. She's a really interesting woman. She lives on a ranch with her father. I wanted to go see her.
Yeah.
It occurred to me, you know what? It's not too late. I you know, the character that you are at the end of the game, maybe I could, you know, kind of strike up a relationship with her. So I go to her house. And of course, she's not there.
Yeah. I wanted her to just be walking around and say, hey, John.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wanted that. And yeah. I didn't get it.
Well, anyway, that's a separate subject.
No. Yeah, yeah.
So I want to get into this a little bit deeper about the question of storytelling. And you get at this in your book in several ways. What is it about video games that you find especially conducive to storytelling? As a person who comes from literature, yeah. What do video games do that you find particularly distinctive or liberating?
They do the sense of immersion. I know it's stupid. Oh, immersion. You know, that's just like a stupid corporate buzzword now. But no, in a narratological sense, they do a form of dramatic storytelling immersion like nothing else has ever done before. And it's just kind of a tragedy that, you know, the only way we've really seen game designers figure out ways to up that magical immersion thing is to have people like find memos or read books or something like that. It seems to me that there's got to be other ways to like stress that beautiful, inimitable, unique to games kind of sense of I'm in a world that is disinterestedly functioning around me. And there's a story out there that I'm going to become part of, that I can affect, that I can shift, that I can change, that, and then there's going to be that great moment of reckoning, which will probably revolve around a boss fight, but God, I hope it doesn't, you know, there's that sense of limitlessness when you're at the beginning of a game that even has like a slightly open feel to it. Mm-hmm. And there's that feeling that I get when I'm putting in a game that it's the feeling of limitlessness, it's the feeling of being in the world, and it's the feeling of agency. Those three things create like an unbelievably compelling set of, you know, storytelling tools that people can work with and do really amazing things with, and that people have done really amazing things with. But that, as we all know, create all these weird, interesting tensions within the very act of storytelling.
This you expand on the very things you're talking about in the book, particularly related to GTA 4, among other games. But you talk a little bit about that. About it was a kind of an immersion that I think probably we use that word, like you say, it's kind of a buzzword. But your kind of immersion with GTA 4 and what happened to you and how all of that affected you was pretty amazing, I thought. I mean, it made for harrowing reading.
shall we do the spoiler, which is that I I've always been like a pretty responsible recreational drug abuser my whole life. And I'm not interested in demonizing drugs. I think people do them for lots of different reasons. Some of them are even, you know, acceptable reasons. And because I was, you know, in a place of sort of personal desperation and unsettledness and, you know, professional aimlessness, I wound up doing a lot of cocaine, and it went to a place of real darkness. And I took my game playing right in there with me. And GTA was the game that I love playing on coke more than any other game. And I've played GTA through so many times, 6 or 7 times. And there's something about that game and that drug that I found, I just found them to be so uniquely self-perpetuating that my identification with Nico, who wanted to do the right thing and he wanted to escape his nature, you know, I really learned things about myself playing that game and answered questions about my own compulsions that had nothing to do with the narrative. It just had more to do with the theme of that game. And the theme is a really rich theme. Can you escape your nature? And I like to think that sometimes you can. And I'd like to think that, you know, if my nature was to be a coked out whack job living in the fringes of the former Soviet Union, which is what I was doing, you can find the better angels of your nature, and you can grab onto them and they can lift you out of it. And so, yeah, that was my experience with that game. And it's kind of been a bummer to see game people think I'm playing into some weird anti-game demonization or trying to tell parents that games are like coke. That's not what the purpose of that piece is at all, or that part of the book. It's just part of the story and about how, like any other aesthetic experience, games can lead you to dark places. They can lead you out of dark places. They can be part of dark experiences. And it felt important to me to write about that, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting. One of my students told me, he's read the book. He's probably not finished it yet, but he has it. And we were just chatting about it. And he said to me, that just makes total sense to me, because playing GTA feels like you're on coke. That the game makes you feel,
and there's tons of coke in the game.
Yeah, and there's tons of coke in the game. But that there's something about the game that there's a certain kind of amped quality to the game, that the experience of being in the game world is a lot to him like what that it's purposely kind of meant to feel like that. And so of course they go together, was his take.
I've kind of wanted to say that, but I resist saying that because I don't want anyone to misinterpret what
sure,
I really mean.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it is like that. And the other fascinating thing about doing tons of coke while you're playing that game is that all the worst people in the game are the ones doing coke. Yeah. You know, like if there's like a murdering bastard who just chopped his wife's head off and put it in the trunk, he's going to be sitting down and blowing a line in front of Nico. And so, you know, as a coke person doing a lot of coke playing the game, you're constantly just forced to look within at the utter shambles of your own morality, you know. And it's like I think I'd like to say my friend Matthew Burns, he and I are email chums, and he actually, when he read that part of the book, he just sent like a one-line email, which was, I think you had the single most appropriate GTA gameplay experience of anyone I've ever known. I thought, yes, exactly, thank you.
Well, just so people know, Matthew writes the Magical Wasteland blog, and he's he's going to be on the podcast soon. So,
oh, he's just one of my favorite game people in the world.
Fine writer. So then, what is it? I mean, why didn't you go off to play other games? What made you keep coming back to GTA 4?
I did play a lot of other games. I played a ton of other games. We can talk about the games I enjoyed on coke if you want.
Well, I mean, you talk about some of them in the book, but that it felt like at the center of that whole thing that you just kept coming back to that game. If it weren't an open world game, I presume. I mean, if there was the certain qualities of that game and the certain kind of landscape of that game, it just drew you back Did you care about Nico? I mean, was it an empathetic thing?
Absolutely. I really love that character, which, you know, I know that you draw the Nico Marston line, that Nico did, that you despise Nico. And maybe it's my experience of knowing a lot of, you know, Soviet bloc men of a certain age, of a certain elastic moral code, shall we say, that I had a lot more sympathy for that guy. Mm-hmm. And so I really like Nico, the character, and I really like him a lot. And I think that last moment where he faces up to his old partner from that unit in the Balkans, that's one of the most riveting, like not shocking. I just, when that scene is unfolding and then it gives control back to me and I'm holding the gun to that guy's head, I wrote in the book, actually did, because it felt too revealing of me. And that's another kind of storytelling thing that games do that is just like so fantastically intense, is that when they create characters and situations that mean something to you emotionally and then give you the power of life and death over characters that they've done an awful lot of legwork to make you feel like they matter and they mean something, and then give you the agency over their very fictional lives. What other form of storytelling does that? The answer is none. And when a game does it really well, I don't know. I give into these experiences. I don't fight these experiences. I give in, and a game really affects me and gets me in the heart. And I let those moments affect me. And I've had some unbelievably affecting, emotionally disturbing, upsetting moments in gameplay where I've made a decision that instantly after I've made it, I thought that wasn't the right thing. Mm. And I love that feeling. I love it.
What's the flip side of this? We talked a little bit about why you think games can be conducive to storytelling. What do you think constrains them? What holds them back for you?
Well, this idea, like as Jonathan Blow says in the book, the idea that storytelling is about forward progression, and then gameplay is all about constantly throwing challenges at the player so they don't, quote, get bored. And so our reigning method of gameplay is to say, okay, here's a story, and then here's the obstacle course that the recipient of the story has to like endure to see more of the story. I mean, it doesn't take like, you know, James Joyce to figure out that these two systemic ways of doing things are diametrically opposed to each other, just like at a foundational level. And so what's cool is like watching video game designers actually figure out ways to mask and or incorporate that tension in ways that feel seamless. And I'd say Portal is one of the games that does it better than any. A very underrated game that I think manages to conceal that tension between challenge and story is Dead Space. Hmm. It's a, you know, kind of a corny survival horror game, but I think that game might be minute for minute the most intense and like just pure riveting video game style storytelling experience I've had in the medium. It's up there with anything else I've played. And how does it do it? It does it, you know, in really smart ways. It makes all of your tasks feel relevant to the fiction. It makes all of the kind of weird video game artificialities feel as though they're serving the fiction and not limiting the fiction. And so, and I think, for, you know, games are now, they make so much money that these methods that we have of like collective, like you were saying before, collectibles work. And so now you have to go in front of a board of people, all of whom have been trained to think collectibles work. Collectibles enhance our gameplay. They lead to achievements. There's things that we can tell game magazines, our news and development process. We now have to like think that we now have to actually face up to the idea that maybe things like collectibles actively damage the storytelling we're trying to do. That's a hard thing to convince lots of people who have actually made a lot of money learning how to do things this way. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and you put a clever person you apply the clever person's brain power to figuring out masking systems. You know, like how can I conceal or mask or otherwise make it feel like you're not collecting this thing that you're collecting and work it into the story.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you have to sort of give them a nod, like, yeah, well, okay, that was pretty clever, you know. but ultimately, you know, down deep that it's really just a fetch quest, or it's a collection thing, or it's a whatever, you know. And RDR is filled with fetch quests.
It is.
You know what they are.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, you kind of, if they're clever enough about integrating it into the story.
But in literary fiction, we have subplots. We have subplots. It's just a subplot, right. But everything is in execution. Everything is how real you make these things feel to the audience. And I, you know, if I have any criticism of game consumers, it's that they're pretty blithe about the way they throw terms around, like it's just a fetch quest, just like you say. And it seems to me that, like, especially in the smarter game blogs, there's so many really smart people that are otherwise seem weirdly invested in fighting games and fighting the ways they try to, you know, create plausible. And by plausible, I don't mean realistic. Those are two different things. But the way they try to create like a dramatically plausible kind of framework for themselves. I mean, so I'm obviously so hopelessly schizophrenic on this question. You know, in one sense, I'm saying fetch quests are stupid. And on the other hand, I'm saying, don't diss fetch quests. You know? I'm all about the disguise. I'm all about the artful disguise of things that call out the limitations of the form.
Sure. And that's, I think Red Dead does it in really interesting ways because you're out there in the world and you can so easily get distracted by what you thought you were going to play for an hour. You wind up doing something completely different because the world sucks you in. And an hour passes and you realize that what you really were doing in that hour, even though you would never have thought of it this way as you were doing it, was like picking herbs or like shooting birds out of the sky. And trying to you know build up your catalog of which ones you've got. So and you're not doing it to really, maybe there's a mission attached to it, but ultimately it becomes its own kind of self-fulfilling. It's fun and you're doing it and it feels fun. So yeah, I mean there you are. It's been integrated into the gameplay. It feels fun and there is actually some storytelling element to it because you can go sell the stuff and you can get better. But I hear what you're saying because I'm the guy then that's going to write the blog piece that says, damn these fetch quests, I'm so sick of them, you know? And I hear you. I mean, it's an odd kind of tension.
Yeah, it is. And I kind of admire designers who just have obviously just thrown in the towel and just said, look, this tension is so inherent to the way games, as we understand them, function, that how can you say that this is a problem with game design? It is game design. I have a certain amount of respect and admiration for that like admission. But, you know, to me, if literary fiction evolved in a way that every story that you read, like basically reminded you every few pages through some inexplicable clumsiness that this was just a piece of writing, that would be very sad to me. So that's where I come from on this.
It's hard not to walk away from your book and wonder if you're going to take on writing for a game. You know, my immediate thought reading your book was, I want this guy assigned to the next really ambitious, interesting game.
I'm starting to do this now. I'm working, I signed all these non-disclosure things. And so I've asked them what I can and can't say. And so what I can say is that I'm working with a bunch of people lately of Pandemic and Obsidian and some other places, and it's a new company that started, and they've got a few games in the hopper, one of which I'm going to be one of three writers on, that I think could be hugely ambitious and could really be an extraordinary thing, and also could be really hard. But if it sounds like I'm taking this stuff even more seriously than I do in the book, it's because now, look, I'm struggling with like these design questions myself, you know. And I just got like an Excel document with like a bunch of characters' names with like ambient response number one, ambient response number two. I have to fill all these things in. I have to start writing 8 ambient responses for 4 different characters. And they have to like be open-ended enough so when one person says something, the other ambient response can kick in. And, you know, this stuff is not easy. And this is like not stuff that as a fiction writer, you're really spending a lot of time thinking about. And so I'm finding these questions as someone who's now sort of dipping his foot into this as like a writing challenge, as I'll be quite frank and say, absolutely exhilarating. Yeah. I write short stories and pieces of magazine journalism. I love writing these things. the short story is a closed form. I'm not going to figure out any new way to do anything in the short story. I think I can write a really fine short story. I hope, at least. I try to, I should say. But the thought that, you know, I'm working on this game with these other guys and we're all like actively thinking of ways to incorporate storytelling elements in games that honor the gameplay pact, but also don't give away the farm, in terms of like dramatic effect, to actually think of ways that honor both these things equally at the same time, man, it's not easy. And I could, you know, a year from now, I may be running in horror from this process, but I hope I don't, because just this tiny glimpse I've gotten so far at the inside of this process, I'm kind of hooked. I think it's fascinating.
Well, I hope when you have more to say, the more you can say, that we can chat about that.
I'm very
intrigued.
I would love to.
I have to say, this is going to come out wrong. I know it, because it's going to seem like I'm an arrogant prick or something. But I've gone to GDC several years, and I go to these talks about storytelling and stuff. And I've often thought that it's guys in the room, and they are mostly guys, who are essentially kind of engineering minds. You know, they're really smart guys, the guys that intimidated me in school, you know, like really good at math and really good at like stuff that I'm bad at. And they're having these like revolutionary discoveries about storytelling, or in my case, particularly about voice acting and about performance. And I go to certain sessions at GDC, which are devoted to that. And they're talking about this stuff like they've just uncovered this massive. I'm like, God, you know, we've been doing this for 200 years.
Manhattan Project.
Yeah, it's yeah. And I think, you just need a few more people in the room who are really good at this. And I'm very encouraged by the idea that now it's flipped. Now you've got a storyteller who has a disciplined approach and who understands that, who's now in the position of doing what they've got to do. And I so admire them for it. They've got to learn as much as they can, as fast as they can, about storytelling. And you've got to learn as much as you can, as fast as you can, about game design. Yeah. And about how to make a real game. And you know, you sort of lose your all your sort of fancy idealistic, you know, notions, because there's reality facing you of getting the thing made. And I just think that balance is healthy, that we need more people working from both ends of it.
I think so too. And I think that, you know, one of the big problems with game writing, when they've wanted like a fancy game writer, they brought in like a comic writer or a big budget movie writer, neither of whom necessarily understands, you know, step fucking one of what makes an interesting game. And I don't think it's a mistake that a lot of the kind of big splashy names they brought in to quote write games, none of those games have been very good as far as I can tell. Yeah. And I, you know, should we name names? I mean, I there's some big budget games that have come out recently. Well, I've written about this publicly, Assassin's Creed 2. I thought that was just one of the most unforgivably badly written games I've ever seen in my life. And watching people, it seemed like a game written by someone who was trying to write a movie that happened to be mildly interactive. And so that game's like wrestling with its narrative, and then it's like emergent narrative, or whatever you want to call it, that seemed to me like just grade A as how not, like exhibit A, how not to do this. And yet people loved it. So what the hell do I know? I mean, we were going to say that about acting, and this must drive you crazy as someone who's like, you know, a professor of theater, I'd love to talk to you about this, because my girlfriend, my beloved girlfriend, sweetie, if you're listening to this, I love you, is an actor, and she just like goes bananas at like saying these people are obviously not in the same room together. They're talking to a wall. They're talking to a microphone. Why do game people do this? It's just wooden. It's terrible. You know, blah blah blah. Well, I now know why they do this, because for certain kind of open world games, just like I'm saying, I'm writing these ambient responses, right? You can't have these two actors in the same room recording these things, because they're triggered through random interactions with the environment.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, it would do no good to have two actors going back and forth in these scenes, because... and so then the guy I'm working with, I'm like, well, why don't we have all of the, like, cutscene kind of things with the people together? He's like, so you want to have the actors all come in twice? Mm-hmm. And you like do like ambient stuff once, and he's like, you don't really understand how this works, because you can't really do that. Like, the actors' agents are going to allow that. You've got to like be cost effective. And now I'm beginning to realize, oh, this is why game acting is so bad.
Yeah, and part of it is incompetence. Part of it is that there are still games made that, you know, have voices played by, you know, the assistant sound designer.
Is that
who's
true?
In the room. Yo, it still happens. Sure. It still happens. I mean, not like it used to, but, you know, not every game is, well, I'm playing a DS game right now, which is not a AAA game. But it, you know, it was supposedly got this big makeover with all these new visuals and the voice acting and stuff. Right now, and I'm listening to the voice acting, and it is among the worst examples of voice acting I've heard in the last 15 years. Wow. And that game just came out.
Yeah. I see that and I raise it. Alpha Protocol.
Well,
I'm going to do my impersonation of the guy playing Michael Thornton. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, please.
My name's Michael Thornton. I was just shot and I'm trying to break into the safe house to steal the files. Hey, Mina, would you please help me do that? That's his performance. It's just pitched at that level throughout the entire game. It's a strange sort of anti-achievement, the purity of the guy's performance.
Yeah,
just how,
yeah. He's taken detached to a new level.
But I want to know is, like, at what point in the development process was everyone involved in that game sitting down listening to that guy reading those lines, and they're plugging them in and they're like working with it and thinking, yeah, this is the wagon we are going to tie this entire project's star to.
I worry that I think that it's, they're just audio cues. They're just cues. They have numbers attached to them and they go here and they go here. That there isn't often someone in that position. I mean, I'll tell you that when I attended the Naughty Dog session on how they do their VO and their mocap stuff for Uncharted 2, I was in the room with a lot of people from a lot of different, you know, design houses and studios and stuff. And there were two reactions. One was, oh my God, like, so that's how you do it, you know? I mean, they put the actors around a table, they rehearse, they get them way early, they improvise, they use the improvised stuff, they use 75, 80, 90%, some crazy high number of the recording they do on their feet actually makes it into the game.
Yeah.
And so that's all cool. But then the other, that's the first response was, wow, okay. The second response is, oh my God, do you realize how much that would cost?
Yeah.
That is impossible to even consider for most, you know, development houses, that you would go to that much time and effort and put that much money into it. So
I dispute that a little tiny bit, if only though you hire cheaper actors. You can go guerrilla on that stuff and do just as much stuff, I think. Mocap suits are not, I mean, they're expensive, but if you're a game studio and you want to make a game that uses those kinds, wants to use cutscenes and is devoted to storytelling, I just think you go the extra mile and you actually spend the money to do it.
Yeah.
I think you just do it.
Yeah.
You just do it. You pull the trigger. If that's the kind of game you're going to make, fucking make that kind of game.
Well, the actors are there too, let me tell you. This is the thing that most people don't understand about VO work is that it's easy work for actors.
Yeah, exactly.
And there are so many good actors. You take one good actor, every actor in Uncharted 2, for example, and I could give you 5, 6, 10 actors lined up right behind that guy who would be just as good as he was.
Yeah.
You just don't know his name. You've never heard of him. But, you know, give him 2 weeks and he would be spot on.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, I do you have a few more minutes?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
So this games as art thing, which I've promised never to talk about again on the podcast, you mentioned something in the book. I just want to note this, and I'll read it briefly because it gets at it in a particularly useful way. So here's what you say. It seems to me that anyone passionate about video games has better things to do than walk chin first into a sucker punch argument about whether they qualify as art. Those who do not believe video games are or ever will be art deserve nothing more goading or indulgent than a smile. that strikes me as a perfectly wonderful take on this raging issue that we've been talking about for so long.
Well, that's advice I myself have not been able to take.
But yeah, no, thank you. I'm rather fond of that section too, because I think it's true. I think this whole question, anyone who loves games should just walk away from this. Yeah. It's so self-evidently false. So, you know how I rephrase this question. I've already said this in a few interviews. I'll say it to you. I don't know if you want to hear it or care. The question is not, are video games art? The question actually is the video game medium viable for artists to work in and express themselves? And who could possibly say no to that question? No one. You turn the question around. You take the onus off the medium and you put the onus on the artist. That's a totally different question and a much less contentious question. I think, I don't know.
It's easy to get into a defensive posture with this, and then you adopt that because you know that you've got to sort of take on all comers. And sometimes you're arguing with other gamers, as we've discussed. So
yeah, there's that weird Philistine gamer position of they're just games, they're not art, and what, they just have to be fun, and they just have to be this. I want to strangle those people because we're not talking about – the decision here isn't between like fun and not fun. It's holding it to the highest possible storytelling standard in ways that are appropriate to the medium in which it's trying to tell it. And it's like just not being willing to satisfy. It's not. It's as a consumer and a person who loves games. It's just being unwilling to be satisfied for stupid, lazy shit. And if people want to be satisfied by stupid, lazy shit, well then, they can go play Modern Warfare 12. Wow, I just turned really bitter. Let's be happy.
Well, maybe we'll end on a different note.
Yeah, please. And now I'm going to go kill myself.
Well, there is a kind of a cheekiness to all of this games criticism, games reviewing, how we take games on in the blogosphere that you don't necessarily find in film or in other media. And I kind of like it, but it does sometimes drive me crazy. And I'm a full participant in it. The idea that we're just constantly talking about what these game designers should be doing to make it better, The just very fundamental things we're saying, we're looking at what we're seeing and we're saying this could be better and this needs to do this and that needs to do that.
If you were a game designer, wouldn't you want to punch every asshole like us in the face?
Well, that's just it. I mean, I think it interests me that there are some designers who seem truly interested in this conversation, and I'm sure it tries their patience like crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Maybe there are a few nuggets along the way. Maybe we can be useful to them. I got to say, you can reverse this too. It's very, very rewarding. I was talking about Rich LeMarchand, the Uncharted guy who was at this conference I was just at, and we were talking about a couple of the pieces I'd written. I love it when people comment on my posts, my readers and stuff, and I feel like I have friends in that community. But when the guy that made the game says, that thing you said about my game, that really meant a lot to me because I felt like that you got something that I tried very hard to communicate, and that resonated with him. I got to tell you, I mean, it's a little chill up my spine. I mean, this is the whole thing for me, like that we can talk to each other from the critic's perspective and the creator's perspective and find some common ground. And he knows there are certain things I didn't like about the game. We talked about that too. Mm-hmm. But like, that's a real conversation.
That's the thing I love about game designers, and I say this in the book, is that more than any other creative artists type people I know, they'll actually talk to you about what didn't work.
Yeah.
They'll bring it up. And the line in the book is that never in my life have I met a writer with a blood alcohol content below 0.2% ever willing to like have that conversation.
Yeah.
And so while I do think like game people are probably understandably irritated by our certainty about everything that's wrong with games, and I just want to say again, I don't think we're completely full of shit. I think we're only occasionally full of shit on that question. And I do think, we can all learn from exchanging this stuff. At the same time, they're an extraordinarily open and just like accessible group of people who also happen to be at the helm of the single most profitable storytelling medium in the world right now. That's weird, isn't it?
It is.
It's terribly weird.
It is. They're not insecure. I mean, they're not certainly not from what I'm used to. I mean, I work in the theater. I mean, just even the slightest hint that someone's performance might not have been perfect. And, you know, they're just going crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm, you know, stereotyping. But, I mean, we're all very sensitive artists. And these game designers often, sure, they're sensitive. But you know, you can, many of them are up for that conversation.
Yeah, well, I think they all sort of know. And the, just the tiny glimpses of the inside of the process that I've now gotten, it's not like all the stuff we're saying, it's not like it's news to them, right? And I think maybe if you know, critics can do this form any good, I think the only really good thing that we can do is maybe allow them to be more vocal about entrenched game design orthodoxies that even everyone on that side of it is sick of.
Right.
That, but I think just out of kind of inertia and, you know, quite, and I don't want to work quite as hard either when I'm writing short stories, you know, I resort to the same old bag of tricks all the time too. And it's only when my editor or my fellow writer friends say, dude, you did this, you already did this. And they give me my story back. And I get very hurt. And then I realize they're right.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So I think people like us and having these conversations, for all the times we're wrong and annoying, I think just as often we may, critics, I don't mean you and I mean, just mean the critic, may give people on the design side of things like the courage to deviate from stuff they're probably sick of doing themselves anyway.
Right.
And so I hold that up as like a duty that the critic of this medium in particular can really capitalize on. I mean, this medium right now is probably more open to directional influence from critics than any other medium I can think of at the moment.
I'm assuming that they believe that's true as well. And they, meaning at least enough of them that they don't kick us out of GDC.
Yeah.
That and partly I think that may be because they understand that they've got some teaching to do for, I mean, I've learned so much going to GDC, and I think that it's informed my writing in the sense that I'm more sensitive, or at least I think I am, to the realities of what they face. So that, you know, in order for me to be a critic, I need to learn what I need to learn too. It's not just about, well, here's how you need to make your game better, you know, that they need, it's helpful for me to understand the economic imperatives, the constraints they deal with, time, all the crazy stuff that I don't face in my creative process. They've had to teach me that so that I don't go off half cocked when I write about what they do.
Yes. Yeah. I agree. And I think for people who are not lucky, who, you know, love games or are interested in games and who just aren't fortunate enough to get that glimpse under the curtain and realize that this machine is actually way more complicated and scarier than, you know, you may think, that I would just encourage all of your listeners to not be more gentle, but to certainly, you know, be more willing to try to see the other side of it before you come down so harshly. Because, you know, you get in a conversation with people that are really serious about their video games, man, people, because it is such a contested medium right now, passions run very high. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I hear people talk smack about, say, Mirror's Edge, you know, I don't get this mad when someone says they don't, you know, they don't think Jonathan Franzen's a good writer.
Yeah.
I might think, well, Franzen's obviously a great writer, but I don't like turn on them and say, Jonathan Franzen is so a great writer. And blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, it's weird, right? That's what's so exciting of a medium, that just everything is there.
Yeah.
And to have like, you know, abandoned my promising literary career to become the person who wrote maybe like the first kind of literary book about this subject. Shit, what can I say? I just feel very lucky right now. I feel very, very lucky.
Well, as I mentioned before, that book is called Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter. You will see, if you haven't already seen, that the lavish praise for the book is starting to really pour out now from the major media sources. as well as, you know, the small sites and the blogosphere and various other places, and people are getting a chance to read the book. I couldn't be more thrilled for you, Tom. It's well deserved. I've already had my say about it, so I'll encourage people to read it for themselves.
Michael is not telling you something out there in Brainy Gamerland, which is that I have three people who offered advance endorsement of this book. And I hope that this was your first ever blurbination. Is this true?
Yeah, it's funny. I've gotten some Twitter comments from people like, dude, you're on the back of the book. Like, hey, that's pretty cool. So, no, yeah, it's my first time, certainly. And, you know, I couldn't be happier, to be honest. I'm just thrilled.
I thank you very much.
I hope that you enjoy this time of you know, the book just coming out and it kind of being all in front of us, all of us, and we're all chatting about it. I hope that feels rewarding to you. Thank you for your time chatting about the book. And like I said, everyone should read it. And I presume, Tom, you'd be receptive to some feedback on it. And
oh, Jesus. The guy who does the what's his name? He lives in Portland. Jeffrey
Jeffrey. Yeah. Motley,
I have read his blog, and Jeff, if I may, I hereby extend to you an invite to come give me a call. My email is tombissell@hotmail.com. Let's do some gaming.
Very cool. Yeah, those of you who don't know, Jeffrey had posted a thing on the blog saying, I just found out that Tom Bissell teaches at my alma mater, and he lives right down the road. Do you think he'd be willing to talk to me?
Well, once my handlers sort of vet him and...
All the best to you, Tom, and thanks for the book, and thanks for talking with me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care.